the Forged and Unbroken podcast.
Well, the first thing I kind of wanted to dig in on is, let's just ease into this. You have, you know, the longer I do this, I see your fingerprints start popping up in all kinds of places, which is super cool. But before we even get to that, I'd love to know just some of the culture of Raleigh. Like, what, like, I love the Carolinas. I don't get to spend as much time in the section that you're at, but what is some of the things that are just unique to where you're at?
Fire service wise or just in general?
Let's do both.
Yeah. Well, so I think the Carolinas are a really unique area because we are in the South.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of what comes with being in the South. And for example, and that ties both with the fire service and just Raleigh in general. You know, the fire department, around the time I joined, up until then, they 90% of the hires were from local volunteer fire departments.
Yeah.
So you had like the city of Raleigh, the big city of Raleigh, but all the employees for the Raleigh Fire Department were local volunteers for these smaller country departments. And it was a clash of cultures. And, you know, and at times it was like people came in to work in the city and that was like their entertainment. And then they went back home to where, you know, everything was a slower pace, different attitudes. And I've seen that just growing up across all things. You know, I was born and raised in Raleigh. I went to NC State, which is in Raleigh. And then right after I graduated, I actually was a police officer first.
Oh, neat. All right.
Yeah. And in college, I got a scholarship. And I didn't really understand what I was getting myself into. I wish I did. But the goal of the scholarship, which they paid my college, which was amazing.
Nice.
But in return, I had to sign a contract to work for a smaller department that did not have as many college-educated people. So the goal was to get college-educated people into these smaller departments. Well, yeah. At the time, I didn't understand the implications of that and what I was stepping into. And it really was a slap in the face because my first job was 30 minutes away from home for the Smithfield Fire or the Smithfield Police Department. But I was a Muslim female, college educated, 22-year-old kid walking into this culture that was not used to anything that I brought. And I didn't know any of that. I didn't understand it. And so my eyes were just, you know, open wide to the world very quickly.
Yeah, for sure. That's not that you're an anomaly, but like, that's not what, I guess, what's what they're used to and what's common. So how did that evolve into the switching over to the fire service then?
So about 2 years into the program, a department closer to home participated and I just wanted to get back closer to home. So I asked if I could switch departments and I was able to. So I came to a department closer to home, which, I mean, it was just day and night difference in everything. But that was also, and they say about 5 years, 3 to 5 years into work as a law enforcement officer, most law enforcement officers do go through burnout. Mm-hmm. And everything that I thought coming into the profession, you know, I was going to make an influence, an impact. I was going to make a difference. I was going to develop community relations, you know, all these like ideas you get in college, in the academy, watching TV shows, just they didn't happen. And in fact, I spent most of my job day to day writing reports and most of the job day to day responding to things that had happened that I could not change. And one of the things that I was passionate about and wanted to do was I wanted to work with young people. I wanted to have relationships with young people and help, you know, create like those relationships. But I just saw the complete lack of trust. And that was really difficult. Like me as one person, I couldn't overcome the lack of trust between, you know, law enforcement community and lower income. And so about 4 years into my career as a law enforcement officer, I learned about this television show called Rescue Me. Because I actually started volunteering for the local EMS department. They had a rescue in EMS. And I don't even know why I started volunteering. I don't know. Something drew me into it. Maybe it was the community. So I started volunteering while all the guys there were watching Rescue Me.
Yeah. And
up until that point, I didn't think women could be police or women could be firefighters. I didn't think women should be firefighters. I really thought the fire service was for men. I knew that they lived there for 24 hours. And I felt like a woman coming into the fire service would disrupt that and would be inappropriate. But season 2 of Rescue Me, they had the female. And it was really cool watching her. And so I started asking more questions and paying more attention. And I realized that there were women in the fire service, and Raleigh Fire Department had women. And so I just, as a police officer, I was so jealous of the fire department. They would come on scene, they would do their thing, and they would leave. And at Garner Police Department, they actually gave us keys to the fire station. So in the middle of the night, we could, like, you know, go in there, use the bathroom, do reports, or at 3 a.m., find a recliner and just take a break, which may or may not have happened often. Sure. But, you know, we'd also drop in around dinner time and just see the community. I just, one thing that, like, I noticed was how much laughter took place in the fire service. And we just didn't have that in law enforcement. You were in the car by yourself. You might've had a beat partner where, you know, my beat partner and I would see each other when we'd stop by the fire station. And so we'd see each other maybe 20 minutes a shift. And so I developed the jealousy of what the fire service did. But at that point too, you know, I was going to court and the system won every single time. You would do a good job, maybe stop a drunk driver. It was plain as day that this person was drunk and shouldn't be driving, and something small would get them off. Whereas you would see people who had no resources, people who were lower income, man, they'd have the book thrown at them. And so I was starting to just develop this burnout, frustration, unhappiness, and Rescue Me came.
That's awesome. I often reflect on that. That was one of those, like, one of the original series that my wife and I, like, just binge watched. I mean, just some of the golden quotes that came out of that. It's so interesting though, that I certainly feel the same thing. I've never been on the police side. Obviously we work really closely with them. I personally couldn't imagine working somewhat more by myself, like in the cruiser. And then I know, like, when we leave car accident scenes and they're still stuck behind there doing the paperwork and dealing with all the baggage, you know, we often say we couldn't do each other's jobs. And it's hard for me to put myself in those shoes. So it's neat to see that you got to see both sides of it. And now you've worked your way up to, the battalion chief level, right? So how many years do you have on now?
So I've got 17 with the fire department, and I brought 5 from law enforcement, which fortunately it's all the same retirement system, which is pretty cool.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great. Yeah, very cool. So I'd really like to start digging in to some of the leadership stuff. And before we get there, was it the experiences from the police and seeing the system and maybe the socioeconomic status of people you're serving that started you down this mental health track? Was it a singular event? Like, what was the impetus for, like, where you're at now, like 17 plus 5 later? You're in a pretty unique position and you're making some amazing change. Like, was it a hallmark moment or was it just all these things built up over time?
It really was all these things built up over time. And when I first started going down the path of mental health, I thought that it was for one particular reason. I thought I had the answers, but it actually even took years after that to recognize all that built up to that. So I'll be honest, you know, early in my law enforcement career, early in my fire service career, I had had many roadblocks and I had had conflict. And I look back now and realize that, you know, I started the service, you know, in early 2000s when I thought, especially I graduated from a liberal college, I thought that we as a society were further along than we are. You know, I thought that discrimination, racism, otherism, I thought that that was all stuff from, you know, before my time. So I entered these career paths thinking that we were all, you know, one, and that I can contribute equally and that I would be just as respected as others. And for me, early in my career, I think what was most difficult was there was no outright sexism or racism, nothing outright, but there was subtle things that occurred that took time to understand and explain. And it even took sometimes years to look back and realize, oh, that makes sense now. That's why I annoyed them with that behavior. It wasn't anything other than I should have known my role at the time. So I don't know if that makes sense, but all that to say is, you know, early in my career, I did have some relationship challenges within the workforce that I couldn't understand. So for me, I always looked inward and I was like, man, what's wrong with me? Like, And it was very frustrating because I couldn't understand what was wrong with me and I couldn't understand how to change my behavior. It took years to look back and realize there was nothing wrong with me and it wasn't my behavior. I was starting to pave a path, which it actually really is cool now looking back, because I see women coming behind me who were just as assertive and aggressive, and they are generating respect and they're generating support. Whereas in my time, being assertive and aggressive and wanting to be great and wanting to like get involved in everything was not so accepted. And I remember one of the things that like for years people would, criticize me for was because I brought my law enforcement background. We had an arson team in Raleigh. And prior to having interest in the arson team, I always wanted to be a part of the USAR team because that looked super cool. Yeah. So I put in for the USAR team. Well, I filled in at the station that had the arson investigators, and they're like, oh, you were a cop. You have a talent. You should consider this. So I started looking down that and I was like, huh, I actually, with my court and report writing and evidence history, I would actually be an asset here. And the way it was is you put in for things and it's a gamble if you'll get in. Yeah. So I put in for both and I pursued both. I took the classes for both and I thought nothing wrong of it, but for years I was criticized for wanting to do too many things. And it was really weird, even hearing people talk about it now. It's like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, I had no control of what I would end up with. I wanted to give myself every opportunity possible. But at the time, like literally that was like, she doesn't know what she wants to do. She wants to do everything, so she shouldn't be able to do anything. And that was the attitude, which was so weird.
You kind of explained it a little bit. We could talk about just this one topic for so long, kind of leaning into some of the nuance of this. Was it the self-awareness over time? Was it, and you did mention that there was some of it is just maybe the generational differences of where we were then compared to now. Did you take like more of a rescue me approach where like you just leaned in like, hey, I'm here, like buckle up and like it's all good, you leaned into some of that culture? Or was it more having other people having to accept that over time? Like, I know it's a nuanced question there. Like, how did you handle that?
So I think what I regret, which I don't regret, we all learn and grow, is I cared too much about what people said and what people thought. Yeah. I cared so much. And one of the things that is dominant with the fire service is respect, respecting those that came before you, respecting tradition. So I believed in that respect and I listened and I leaned into the respect. So when people would criticize me, when people would have a problem with what I was doing, I respected their opinions enough to where it made me change my behavior or it made me question myself. And I realize now, it's so funny, I didn't know this at the time, but like the investigator team was actually super competitive. There was only 2 part-time investigators per shift and they got 5% for that. And it took 4 years to gain that certification. Whereas year one, I had all the qualifications. I didn't understand at the time. So I came in as a new person with all the qualifications and all of a sudden, who the heck is she? She's taking something away from us. So the criticism wasn't anything negative towards me as a person. It was what I took away from them, which I didn't realize at the time. Of course, looking back, I should not have put so much weight into their opinions. And that is definitely something, and we know like when we study bullies and we study, anything, that generally it's the people who care too much that become like the victims. And I cared too much about what people thought. And so that's definitely a regret of mine. But also at times there was lack of self-awareness. I didn't realize, I didn't realize that, for example, that pursuing the investigator was intimidating or taking something away from others. I just thought that like, look at me, I have this background, I can contribute. I hope people like me because I'm bringing something to the table. Whereas it was the total different thing is, who is she? But at the time I thought the more I had the offer, the more respect that I would gain. Does that make any sense?
Oh, for sure. For sure. And I think at a certain point, especially, being a little older, hopefully a little wiser, that's probably more a reflection of their beliefs and their self-esteem and how they perceive themselves. And it is a reflection of you, right? Ultimately. Now the outward appearance is that that's affecting you. And then you start questioning things for sure. And it can affect you in work relationships, but at the end of the day, that probably is just a reflection of how they perceive themselves, which is sometimes, well, it's a hard pill to swallow for all parties at that point.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's the one regret is I should have understood that. Well, I wish that I had understood that at the time, that, you know, there's nothing wrong with me pursuing things that I find interesting. There's nothing wrong with me taking classes and trying to be an asset in other areas. But that's ultimately what truly led me down to the mental health side, because I did care so much. I wanted people to like me. I wanted to fit in. And in fact, when it was time to promote to driver, at the time I was working for, to me, one of the best company officers we had on the fire department. Like, he was a legend. He was badass. And he was great. And I was very fortunate to get to work for him. I was assigned with him at three different stations early in my career, which was super cool. And I remember getting ready for lieutenant's test. I was like, man, I don't want to do this. Like, I'm on a ladder truck with you. Like, I have a great company. And he basically said, if you don't score in the top five, I'm going to transfer you. he pushed me to promote. And again, at the time, I knew, you know, there hadn't been a lot of women at the Raleigh Fire Department yet. There had been some, but not a lot. And we were at that stage where sometimes the guys would pit us against each other. Like, they would tell me, don't be like so-and-so, she's this. Don't be like so-and-so, she hates women. And it seemed like, you know, people were saying things to me that were pushing me away from the women. And it didn't seem like it truly was happening. But one of the things I wanted to do was be just as good, if not better, than the men. So when it came time to promote, I studied really hard, I did really well, and I scored top of the list. And I thought in doing so that I gained all of their respect, and I showed them that I belong, that I'm competent. Unbeknownst to me, the hearsay in the background was, you know, who does she think she is? She hasn't been here long enough. She's book smart. She can't do the job. She's just book smart. So these negative things were being said.
You can't win.
Yeah. So it was like, man, you can't win, right?
Yeah.
Like, dang. And it's funny, for a couple of years, I look back and I was like, man, I wish I had done poor, like, on the test, because then I would have earned their, what? Like, that makes zero sense.
Crazy. Yeah.
It's ridiculous. So about a year after getting promoted, I was assigned at a firehouse, and there was a guy there who everybody liked. He was like a teddy bear, literally a teddy bear. He was one of those senior guys who'd been on the job for about 20 years, had never promoted, but, you know, it was that guy that people liked. Well, from day one, that guy did not like me, and he would not look at me. He would not talk to me. The more I did not let him see that it bothered me, the more outward he was in his behavior, to the point where he would mock me right in front of me. He would tell people whatever about me. Because I remember one day somebody else was floated in, and we had a nutrition store, like, that you can cut through the woods right behind the firehouse. And I was talking to him about that, and we're about to walk over, and I look over and I see this prick, like, being like, you know, don't go with her. And it was so weird. It was like so childish. But I remember when I would come to work and he was there, it was a miserable day. Like, I was very lonely. I did not feel like a part of the team. And if I'd come to work and he was off, it was like the complete opposite. Like, everything was great. It was so weird. But every day I came to work with this attitude of, I'm going to be competent. I'm going to be kind. I'm going to win him over. Like, I came to work hoping that we'd run some major call and I would prove that I was worthy. Of course, that never happened. And every day I got off work and I was exhausted. I didn't understand at the time this whole hypervigilance idea, that where when you're not yourself for 24 hours, like, there's a baseline and you fall below it. Yep. So I got off work and, I mean, I fell way below it. Some days I would, like, I'd get in the car and I'd cry driving home. I would get back in bed, even if we didn't run a call, I'd stay in bed for hours. I had no energy. I didn't want to be around people. Like, I was really, I guess, believing his treatment was, like, worthy. So I didn't feel good about myself. So when people wanted to be around me, or my family wanted to be around me, I didn't want to be around them because I felt like I was fake. It's very hard to, understand and explain logically, but in the time, that's sure. What was happening. So that sent me down just a really negative, depressed path, where I was having thoughts of suicide a lot. I went to a primary care physician multiple times, got different antidepressants, which didn't work. I didn't understand that therapy was a thing and the value of therapy. Also, I was so humiliated by my experience. I didn't want to tell anybody that, like, I wasn't cool and that somebody was being mean to me, because I felt like that was humiliating. So I kept it all to myself. Fortunately, oddly enough, just life is awesome at times. I started graduate school on a whim. One of my friends started graduate school. He actually ended up not even finishing. So he got me to do it and then he didn't finish. But right at that time where I was having serious depression, serious thoughts of suicide, I had an assignment, and the assignment was action research. So find an area where current practices are not best practices, research and help develop better practices. We had a pretty cool safety chief at the time. So I emailed him and said, hey, you know, can you give me a suggestion on something that I could research for this, you know, assignment that maybe could benefit the fire department? This was fall of 2015. And he said, can you research firefighter suicide? And if you remember 10 years ago, we were not talking about firefighter suicide. I remember like I printed some papers that I found on the internet and I'd keep them upside down because I didn't want anybody to see what I was reading because I was so afraid, like if they'd see it, then maybe they would know I was having thoughts of suicide and what would happen. So I remember I hid the research, but I found so much solace in the research because it explained why I was feeling the way I was feeling. It explained what was happening. And Dr. Sabia, she did a dissertation in 2007, and it was on North Carolina firefighter suicides. And if you've seen that number that a firefighter is 3 times more likely to die by suicide than in the line of duty, that came from her research because she looked at every death certificate over a 15-year period. But what was fascinating about that was not the objective of her dissertation. That was not even the key point. She actually explained very well what drove, you know, firefighters and first responders to suicide and thoughts of suicide. And one of the things she talked about was women and minorities and ostracism and not being a part of the tribe and, you know, not being able to be authentic. And that's what really like connected me to the research. And yeah. I look back and it's amazing because she kind of had a lot of the answers in 2007. But we weren't ready for those answers. All we did was take that number and just highlighted the problem and attributed it to the wrong things and, you know, continue that false narrative for a long time.
Yeah. Wow. That's interesting. I didn't realize the origination point of that research. That's cool to hear. I know it's a little bit of a leap, but I wanted to dig into a couple of main themes in the book and leadership perspective, but I think that what you just said is probably a decent segue into the self. And there's this one part where you talk about the trilogy of like goals, pathways, and agency. And you started out talking about the small goals with Lawrence Gonzalez. Like that's one of my favorite books.
Yes.
Deep Survival. And I love, and you know, I use it from the readiness and mayday survival aspect. But you hit 3 points that I think might be a good segue here. Of having small goals, celebrating successes, and always thinking about one more thing to do. So when you get to these points where like the world is crashing on me, these are the things that I can take control of and find these small wins. And they seem simple, but simple is not always easy, right? So if you could, that trilogy that you spoke of, could you kind of give us the cliff notes of the meaning and how we can lean in on that?
Yeah, no. And that's one of the things I loved is, you know, at the same time I'm looking down like this mental health pathway, I'm also still like a student of the game and trying to be a better firefighter. And I remember Chief Zalka, when I was at a conference, recommended Deep Survival.
Yeah.
And it was based on like his Mayday teachings and how, you know, the behaviors we revert back to. And the first time I read Deep Survival, which I've actually listened to it on Audible so many times now. Yeah. And I'll go back to it a lot because it's just so valuable in understanding like how our mind works and how, you know, we seek the path of least resistance and how we create mental maps so easily. But what I thought was really fascinating was Brené Brown. She's the one who shared that trilogy of goals, pathway, and agencies. Mm-hmm. You know, setting a goal that's realistic, knowing how to get there, even if it is one step at a time, and then having belief, the value of belief, which agency is a word that gets thrown around a lot in mental health conversations. But I think agency is so important because even with peer support, what's the most important predictor of if somebody is going to heal, whether it's from some sort of trauma or some sort of addiction, is agency. people have to believe in themselves and they have to make their own decisions. Nobody can tell you this is what you need to do. And if that happens, as long as you're doing what people tell you to do, you'll never heal. You have to get to a point where you believe in what you need to do and you need to do, and you decide to do that thing because you believe in it. But as long as you're doing what you're told, you're going to be stuck. So agency is so important. Well, as I'm reading and listening to Deep Survival, he mentions those exact same things, which is so powerful. And he talks about, you know, people who survive, you know, things that just are utterly unsurvivable. And a lot of times it had nothing to do with their skills. It had nothing to do with their preparation. It had nothing to do with the tools they brought. It was simply a little bit of belief and a willingness to put one foot in front of the other. And that's another thing that, you know, Dr. Brown, you know, shares is, you know, it doesn't take a lot. It's putting that foot right in front of the other, knowing where you're going to go and just taking that step forward. And I've studied so much about suicide and so much from Dr. Thomas Joyner. And, you know, he does an incredible job explaining suicide and trying to help us understand ways to prevent suicide, which I'm not going to, you know, sit here and say, here's how you prevent suicide, because suicide rates are so high right now in the United States that none of us can, you know, honestly say how to change that. Because if we could, the suicide rate wouldn't be up 37% since 2000. But yeah, it's unbelievable. Like in the United States, suicide rates are up 37%, whereas worldwide, they're down about the same. So the United States is one of the only countries where suicide rates are just continuing to increase, which is crazy.
That's incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. But he says something as well, like, for people who are having thoughts of suicide, you have to take the edge off, and little interventions go a long way. And I think that ties into, you know, Lawrence Gonzalez's work with Deep Survival, Dr. Brené Brown's work with understanding the trilogy of hope. And that's all it is, hope. There's this idea that some people have hope and some people don't. And if you have hope, it's because you're some warm, fuzzy person. But the truth is, hope is a cognitive process. Any of us can learn hope. And most often than not, hope is a product of struggle. Without struggle, without, you know, failing and then being able to come back from failure, we don't learn hope. But when we fail and we come back from failure, that's how we learn hope. And that's how we learn that pathway. But the beauty of it all is small interventions go a long way. We learned with Deep Survival, it was not the person who was looking at how to, you know, get out of their predicament. It was the person looking to survive the next hour that survived. And it's remembering just one step in front of the other. If you can just move one step forward, you can gain hope, and then you can take another step.
Yeah. No, and I love that. And I love the lessons that we can pull from these texts that, you know, we're talking about, you know, mountaineering industries or being lost at sea. And the science behind that, you know, I'm taking for survival and mayday readiness. And now you can take it and come at it from like personal improvement and the mental health side of it. So I just love how one simple topic can transcend all these other areas. Something that you got me thinking about is, for lack of better words, wear with me for a second, is like the victim mentality. Some of it's very real. Some of it, I think, is also, we get stuck in those pathways, right? Of all of these things are happening to me instead of being able to have any influence over them. And so we get stuck in that rut. So, you know, I talk about this a lot in some of my writings where people don't lean into the effort. And why is that? What's the physiological reason, or what is the evolutionary reasons for that? It can be, just talking about character attributes, like healthy character, how that affects physical and mental health. But just the one thing that you got me thinking about was, so often people take that more victim status and like, all right, all these things, these external things that I think I have no control over are affecting me. So that's what's getting me stuck in this rut, which is affecting personal, physical, mental health. We're trying to flip the script here, though, and say, yeah, maybe there's all these external things happening to me, but what things can I control in the here and now? How can I accept what's happening to me, flip the script, whether that's through gratitude or through actual literal action, and then find a better place? And that is leaning into that effort. That is leaning into that hardship. And ultimately we're building resiliency, right? And I think that's where hope kind of begets more hope. Is that, am I missing anything with that?
No.
Way to say what you're saying?
No, absolutely. And I definitely, I think some of the reasons that I found myself in that depression was I truly was stuck in the victim mentality. These bad things happen to me. I have zero control. I give up. Like I experienced that a lot, because when bad things happen that are out of our control, or when negative things happen that are out of control, people treat us ways that we don't deserve. It's so easy to be like, man, fuck this person. I give up. And I was there a lot. It's really frustrating when you have no control. And it actually, I read this book. I think if you haven't read it, you would love it based on what I know about you. It's Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement. But it turned out they talked so much about hypervigilance, but then they spent a lot of time in that book talking about victim versus survivor. And they shared several stories of people who were put in positions that were unfair. And then the outcomes based on what those people did when they were put in those positions. And there were true stories about law enforcement officers. So, you know, maybe a law enforcement officer who was unfairly demoted or unfairly missed a promotion. And because of that, they chose to throw their hands up, or they, you know, chose to have a negative attitude. And then because of their choice, everything went downhill. And then they compared it to the survivor who a bad thing happened, but then they made the decision not to let that affect them. And they made the decision to accept it and continue to move forward. And I know it's so simple, but that's something that I have had to like understand and deal with, because even, you know, even recently things happen and you get so frustrated, you want to throw your hands up, and all that's going to do is continue to go down a negative pathway. Whereas sometimes when those negative things happen, the decision to, you know, okay, let me learn from this and let me go forward. Like, yeah, I've taken a couple of steps backwards, but I'm not going to continue to go backwards. And I actually had a recent incident with that. And it was actually fascinating to me that, and maybe it was learned, but immediately thereafter, like I made the decision not to let it affect me. And I made the decision like, okay, I can't control this. It sucks. It's in the past. Let's move forward. And I was very proud of my decision to not let it affect me, because I realized how easy it could have been to dwell on the negative. I was very proud. But then I also, it's funny, at the exact same time, I read a lot, and I know you do too. So it's cool. Have you read the book, The Happiest Man on Earth? It's about and I think it's a newer book, because I'm
thinking of The Book of Charlie. That's a different one.
Yeah, he was about 100 years old when he wrote this book. So he's a Holocaust survivor.
It's in my queue. I know. Yes. Okay.
Such a good book. You'll read it in less than a day.
Like, awesome.
Like, it's one of those that you can't put down. You escape reality. But at the same time, I was kind of going through this difficult thing where I said, you know what? This happened. This sucks. I may have, you know, come down a few notches, but I'm going to keep moving forward and making the attempt to overcome this. You know, I'm reading his story and it's very similar. And I realized that maybe, you know, because we do look at people and we see people overcome obstacles and we're like, wow, that person is unbelievable. I don't know that I could do that. But I truly think that with like the right mindset, any of us will do that. Because I was really like, I didn't think that I would respond the way I did. And then I did. And I realized that sometimes, you know, when everything's stripped away, we will do things that make ourselves proud. I don't know if that makes zero
sense. No, I love that. It's it takes work. I think that's one of the biggest things, is it takes physical and mental fortitude to lean into whether or not I have control over what's happening to me, to like just radically accept what's happening. And then, like you said, one foot in front of the other. It's a tremendous amount of work. Another great segue is when I started looking up some stuff. So myself and Suzanne Kusser did a mental health bit for Training Days last September. And one component of that I always felt, but I didn't realize was so literal and well-researched, was the mental health component in regards to the organization and leadership. and psychological safety in the team. And I know that's something that you and I both have nerded out on. And so I think it's, I want to take it from like the group and then, but also as an individual, starting out just the impact of leadership in the organization and how that can affect mental health. Because, you know, whether it's because of burnout or call volume being understaffed, I didn't realize the numbers and the research that was put behind these things. Oh, these things absolutely affect our first responders. But the first thing I wanted to dig in on was just the psychologically safe team, because a lot of that does start with the leadership. And you talked about, you know, when we experience failure, how to fail forward. And I think there's a, that's a, probably a layer of psychological safety. But that's like a major component of it. We don't, if we are in a position where we're in a rut, or if we do experience failure, it's harder to come back from that when we don't have the healthy group dynamics, whether that's within the team in the firehouse or that's coming from up above. So let's lean in on that right now.
All right. And I want to apologize for this in advance, but I want to say, because I didn't get the opportunity, how honored that I am to be on this podcast. And I say this for this reason. When I heard you at training days, you blew me away with your knowledge and ability to convey the message that I've been researching. And I was like, wow, this guy gets it. He's the real deal. Like every aspect of your message, your ability to deliver, and even you as a person, like, you're doing a great job and I'm honored to be here.
Well, the feeling's mutual.
So I know people like hate when they get the kudos.
Yeah, I'm blushing over here.
Yeah, no, I immediately told Chief Lieb with the First Responder Center for Excellence, because we do one day workshops and we incorporate like mental health. I was like, we have to get this guy on our team, because we also do functional fitness workshops. It's like, this guy needs to be on our team. He's like, he epitomizes everything that we're doing. Awesome. So keep your ears out, because we, you will awesome. Be
thank you.
In to the team. But yeah, so I initially started researching mental health and suicide selfishly for my own benefit and understanding why I was struggling. Plus it was neat that it was a topic that I was recommended, but it was very selfish the whole time trying to understand myself, but then realizing I'm not the only one. So then I did have something like to go after. Not only was I trying to understand myself, but now I understand the fire service in general is struggling to understand suicide, and we are losing people to suicide. And maybe my research can benefit that. And at the time I didn't understand the value of, you know, going for a goal beyond yourself. So looking back now, I see the value of that and how amazing that was. But initially in the research, the solutions all encompassed peer support. And so, you know, around the time I started researching is when peer support teams were starting to emerge, and peer support teams really became the solution to the point where I created our North Carolina peer support team. And since we started in 2017, we've trained over 500 people, which is absolutely amazing. Wow. Yeah, it's so cool. And just understanding that when somebody is struggling, you know, there's no new pain in the world. Whatever pain you felt, somebody else has felt. And if you can connect with another human being and be able to share your pain, feel listened and heard, and especially have like an empathic response, that can be the true like first step to healing. And I experienced that myself when I was going through what I was going through, and I was keeping it all to myself. Fortunately, I had a friend who I don't even know if he knows that I was struggling, but he was just a good friend that reached out a few times. And about three or four times that he reached out, I blew him off, but he never gave up. He continued to reach out, which I look back and I realize how awesome that is, because I know in life, if I reach out to somebody a couple times and they don't have time for me, or they don't talk to me, or they don't call back, I give up. And I look back at a lot of relationships that have, you know, you had these strong relationships and then slowly they dissolved. So I realized like how incredible it was that despite me not answering, or despite me having short answers, he continued to reach out, to the point where one day he called and I was just especially depressed and especially struggling. And I just let it all out. And he had a very simple response. You know, he said, "Dude, that fucking sucks. I'm so sorry." And with that response though, I heard the pain in his voice. Like I heard him shift from, you know, calling to check in to me sharing what I was going through to that causing him pain. And of course we don't want other people to have pain, but when I could tell that he was in pain because I was in pain, that let me know that I was validated. And it let me know that I wasn't crazy. And I just remember like this weight that came off my shoulders. Up until that point, I had this heavy weight, you know, this depression that I didn't think anybody could understand. And then all of a sudden, the weight's off my shoulders. So I always remember the beauty of that. This guy had zero peer support training. He was just a decent human being. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget that, because as I started going down the path of research and we're, you know, formulating peer support teams, we're getting organizational leaders to understand the value of peer support and the value of training their members and having these teams, something started to happen that wasn't right. We started to over-rely on our peer support teams to the point where a member could come in to work and say, you know, I'm going through a divorce, I'm depressed. And it was a timeout, let's call peer support. And it got to the point where leaders stopped being like decent human beings and they just started referring. And I started to notice the danger of that, because I know that if I come into work and I share with the people around me that I'm going through a tough time and they immediately like refer me to somebody, that's not going to make me feel good.
Yeah.
But
unintended consequence of the peer support team and like these processes, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And to the point where like I'd find myself having to correct people because they were like, let's get you to a peer counselor. Let's get you to somebody trained. And I started having to, you know, correct people like, no, they're not counselors. It's literally peer equal support. That's all it is. There is no unique specialized training. Like the only specialized piece of the training is active listening, like learning to shut up and listen to others. But they're not like mental health experts or problem solvers. They literally are decent human beings providing support. But, so it took a while to connect the dots, but I think Sebastian Younger's book Tribe, yeah, like really started to connect those dots, and how he would explain people were more often than not traumatized, not because of the experience, but because of what happened after the experience. And I love how he describes PTSD as a disorder of recovery. And so then we started to understand the research beyond or surrounding that recovery and what was necessary. And a lot of times social support was the strongest predictor of reduced PTSD severity. And we know in our organizations that that social support falls under the leadership and the value of leadership. And, you know, 2017 research paper found supervisor support was the strongest predictor of reduced PTSD severity. And so then, you know, just tying the relationship between PTSD, between emotional problems and just support, and looking at things like, you know, something I reference a lot is there was a paper written years ago and it referenced World War II and the Blitz in London. And they looked at a group of children that stayed with their families and compared them to the group of children that were sent to safety. And the children that did better were the ones that endured the war and the bombing and stayed with their families. And then Sebastian Younger even talks about how, you know, war is terrible. It sucks. But then oddly enough, afterwards, people miss the community that war created. Yes. And I think we can all relate, like hurricanes here. The hurricanes suck. It's hot. You have no electricity. You can't get anywhere. But then you look back and there's something about the community and something about slowing down and the connection with others that you kind of miss that you don't have in your day-to-day life.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so both those quotes, I remember in the book and I love them because they make it so real. I think in Sebastian Younger's book, it was the Bosnia-Herzegovina conflict when they were talked about that, just that sense of togetherness. And everybody talks about 9/11, but how great 9/12 was, right? It's having that community, going back to what you said earlier, it's having the empathy, and as firefighters and especially a guy, not something that's like, you know, at the forefront always. And through my own personal work, like that absolutely can be a very learned skill, more active listening, learning to lean into like, yeah, that does suck. Just validating that has been a huge shift in how I operate and how I see others now. And it's like, and just like you said, it's that one small line that can change the entire interaction and make them feel seen. Something else that I thought was pretty neat in the book that you included was simple things from leadership, like military doctrine. You had a really cool piece in there about how in the World War One and Two era, the word love was referenced 13 times. And now in today's language, that has been taken out and it's been much more sterilized to using words like tactical and strategic and operational. And through policy, we've kind of removed some of that love language and that brotherhood and camaraderie, and we have sterilized it. And I understand some components of it, but that's just one small area where we have taken away some of that togetherness, created some otherism. And you've also said it's mission over policy, right? So even if something as small as written word changes the mindset and the framing with which the organization is going to work through and how we signal and articulate our values now is like a fundamental, almost step one thing that we're completely missing on, but we could absolutely lean in on just to, you know, initially affect some better togetherness, the camaraderie, the trust, and just stronger mental health. And I think it's just so amazing that diving into mission, being mindful of our language and just our written word within an organization is going to affect how we operate in the field. Because then as leaders, then we can message that out. And that's just a huge shift. And we think about how old school World War One character traits might be, you know, we start thinking of like the boomer generation and the things before that. But from your research in your book, like they actually nailed it, at least in this component, right? Like, I think it's so amazing.
No, absolutely. And it's funny because I didn't answer your previous question, but now I can tie them to the previous question that we skipped over. Because understanding mission, which actually, when I was going through EFO, the fire chief of the Meridian Fire Department was one of our instructors. And he was the first person that talked about a mission-driven culture and what that means. And an example he used was his department was responding to a cardiac arrest. And there was a gate and they couldn't get through the gate. And the policy, your truck hits something, you get written up. So nobody's going to hit anything because of that. But they recognized what their mission was to save lives. And that is far more valuable than a small like scratch on their truck. So they hit that fence to get through and to, you know, take care of the patient. And he explained like that right there is mission-driven culture, because they knew in doing so, they violated a policy. But he does not want to have a fire department that policy is, you know, is the dominant thing. It's the mission. What is our mission? And so every decision that's made is based on the mission. And so that kind of loops back to what you talked about earlier in understanding leadership and psychological safety and all of that good stuff, because, you know, I think the organization that we study the most or we reference the most often when talking about psychological safety is NASA. Mm-hmm. And we recognize, I mean, and I think for anybody, it's easy to understand why NASA is important, because you look back to Challenger and Columbia and you see lives lost because of what we understand today was a lack of psychological safety. But oftentimes it's dismissed and, you know, it's just normalization of deviance. But it wasn't just normalization of deviance. It was inability or fear of speaking up, fear of admitting mistakes, because in psychologically unsafe environments, it is kill or be killed. It is look out for yourself. If you admit to making a mistake, you could lose everything. So maybe if you hide that mistake, you could be protected. Or, and very similar from NASA to the fire service, is this hierarchy. And, you know, is the probie allowed to tell the chief that something they're doing is dangerous? And yep. There are some fire service cultures where if a probie points something out to a chief, man, they're going to be destroyed. But, and I love the way Chris Bloom is and the way he is with his department. It doesn't matter what your rank is or who you are. If you have something to contribute that's going to help the entire team, you need to contribute that. And not just teaching people to contribute, but also teaching leaders to ask questions out of curiosity and understand the processes. Hey, help me understand why you made that decision. Help me understand, you know, have you thought about possible outcomes if you were to do the opposite? So just asking these questions, process accountability, which goes back to understanding the mission. And so NASA and that, you know, the the person who took over NASA after all the disasters, when they shifted from what they called a performance culture, where all that mattered is flights taking off on time and everything being perfect, to what they called a learning culture, which in that learning culture is where psychological safety took place. Because in the learning culture, it was okay if your flight didn't take off on time, if that meant that we corrected a problem and we learned from it, so that that way that flight could perform better. So it is ironic because we moved away from a performance culture, but in doing so, we were actually improving performance. So the CEO of NASA said that she'd walk around with a 3x5 note card. And on that note card, there were questions, you know, just about the process. And it would remind her to be curious and ask these questions, not be judgmental, be curious, make people feel seen and heard and valued. So that way we could understand process accountability. But that in itself was like the greatest lesson of psychological safety, is the ability to make mistakes and be okay with them if it meant you were learning from them. And I think that for, you know, the fire service, we need more than anything, because I remember the fire service that I first entered was a fire service of performance. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to do everything great. I remember there were things that I realized I was not good at that I didn't work on because I didn't want anybody to see me working out. Like, for example, mass drills. I wouldn't do any mass drills because I didn't want to get caught doing mass drills, because, you know, then I'd be admitting to not being great. I look back and I laugh, because right now as a battalion chief, if I have a company and all they do is spend 30 minutes a day doing mass drills or, you know, ladders or pulling hose, that's it. If they just spend 30 minutes a day doing these simple basic skills, I'm elated, because it means that they are in the top 1%.
Yes.
Sorry,
I didn't mean to cut you off. I so sincerely appreciate this. I often talk about like the outcome versus process focused. We get so cued in on the goals and the end state of things that we forget the entire process that ultimately is supposed to get us there. And when we focus on these processes, we're better able to pick out any issues that we have, and then that will clean up, like you said, to get us to that goal state. Yeah. So it seems so simple of a switch, but all too often organizations are worrying about the numbers and the budget and the crunching and those end states, where we just got to flip that script. That will take care of itself, but we have to lean into managing the processes in a healthy way to get us there. And something else that I think we're kind of leaning into that we're also talking about, like, yes, it is very easy to point the finger at leadership and organizations. And sometimes there are things that we are just not going to be able to influence or change. And so something else that I try to put out there is to also be coachable. So ourselves as individuals, yes, we might be the rookie or maybe the 5 or 10 year person on the shift, but we are also influencing that. So it is very easy to point the finger, but we in turn have to be mindful of the energy that we're putting out there and our work ethic. And that means like, and I think we've already kind of hit on a lot of these things. It's doing the work. It's not being the victim. It is, all right, what things can I accept and then move on with? And then, like you said, failing forward. I know for myself, when we're doing trainings, I really try to make it a point, whether it's I go first or I go last, to get in my gear and do all the same things that all my people are doing. So one, they know that I'm there with them. You know, I'm in the streets doing it. I'm holding myself accountable. They can hold me accountable. And if I fail, then I can also fail forward, right? And I have to trust myself and also the team. Again, I was certainly in that place as a 5-year firefighter, like if I'm doing this thing, that means I don't know it. So I'm just not going to do it. Right. And that's a dangerous place to be. You know, fast forward 15 years, it doesn't even make sense to do it that way, but fear is a hell of a drug, right? Is there anything else I'm missing with just being coachable as an individual? And just, I think just through all these conversations, we're kind of picking up on these traits, but just flipping the script from leadership to now the individual, is there anything else?
Well, and I think leadership plays a role in that too, because I look back at the company that I had right before I made battalion chief, and I had a really good company, and I actually learned from my firefighter. I learned the way to be from my firefighter, because he was very coachable. He was very humble and he was unafraid to say, I don't know, or I've never done this, show me. And just through his behavior, it allowed me to not feel like I had to prove anything or demonstrate. And, you know, you're mentioning, you know, whether you went first or last, every training I would go first. Every single time I'd make a point to go first, even if it meant that I sucked at it or I didn't perform well. And I look back now and it wasn't that I did that because I was courageous and proud. It was because I had a very safe environment with the crew that I had and that I learned from him. And I knew that in this environment, as the leader, I could go first. And going first was, as a leader, a good thing to do because it showed, you know, I'm equal. I'm going to make mistakes and I'm not afraid to make mistakes and learn from them. But it also showed that the crew that I had allowed me to be that way. And I just really appreciated it looking back that I was able to do that. So yeah, leadership is a piece of it because I had to have the humility to behave that way. And the humility to be willing to do that and to make it okay for the whole team to do that. And, you know, again, understanding psychological safety, I think a piece that gets forgotten or misunderstood is how psychological safety just overall improves performance, not just in terms of like keeping astronauts from dying because we stopped a flight and we you know, evaluate what was happening, but from like you've mentioned so many times, failing forward, making mistakes, being able to talk about those mistakes, learn from those mistakes and not make them again, or being able to find better ways to do things. Yeah. I think that was the beauty of just learning and understanding psychological safety, how when you create an environment where people can show up, be themselves, admit mistakes, say, I don't know, you've created an environment where learning is going to continue to happen and people are going to perform better, which is just absolutely beautiful. But I do think that that environment, the leaders have to model it. Like the responsibility is always on the leaders, but the people have to be willing to be coached and to show up and to have humility because, you know, I experienced that and I was fortunate to have that team. I've also worked with people who were very resistant to being coachable. And it's so frustrating because, you know, the blame is here, everywhere. And it's, you know, I feel attacked. I feel instead of saying, hey, let me get better.
And as a leader, I've certainly been in those environments. It is utterly exhausting to keep that frame of mind and keep a positive outlook and continue to show up when that person just wants to point fingers or pull back and withdraw. It is so, so exhausting to still put that foot forward, to still lean in and be like, no, I got you. I'm going to support you. Like you said earlier, I'm going to kill you with kindness and I'm going to keep showing up for you. So as a leader, that is, for lack of much better words, that's kind of where we earn our stripes and our paycheck, is still showing up for that person. Cause it is super easy to be like, all right, chuck the deuces and we're out. And at a certain point, I'm not saying just you get to a point where you're pouring from an empty cup. Yeah, maybe there is a better fit on a different shift or something needs to change ultimately, but you got to keep showing up and you got to do that over a long period of time. And that can be incredibly tiresome.
Oh yeah, no, that's where I think my greatest frustration as a leader is you expect everybody to want to be coachable. You expect everybody to want to get better. And there are some people who their pride is just too powerful or they really don't care. Like they literally, and that's the hardest thing for me is watching the people who, this is just a job, nothing more. And so no matter my influence or my kindness, it is not going to change anything that they're doing. And that's incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, it truly is. So let's, kind of rounding this whole conversation out, let's dig into just gratitude and resiliency, right? So yeah, I know we've already kind of talked on it and so many of these things are interrelated. Having gratitude at the forefront of our mindset, whether that's through a gratitude meditation or to you, what is gratitude? How do we embrace it? And how is that a component of also building resiliency when we're going through these like challenging times?
I think going back to something that you and I have both, started to understand more of is that polybagel theory.
Yeah.
and understanding the value of heart rate variability and how there truly is this biometric that we can utilize to increase our resilience and increase our ability to withstand more stressors and to show up and be effective each and every day. So in that understanding of polyvagal theory and heart rate variability and recognizing that the higher my heart rate variability is, the more I can perform, the more calls I can run, the more exposure to trauma I can endure. I have to also understand those behaviors that will increase heart rate variability. And I think everybody can, answer this question differently, but this is the way I approach it, is just through, because I like the idea of knowing that there's a biomarker and I have control over how that biomarker, you know, presents itself within me. And because gratitude is something that you hear from so many spectrums and the value of, but a lot of us also are very busy people. And it's like, I don't really have time for this. Or, you know, I did gratitude once. It doesn't really matter. But then just recognizing that a daily practice of gratitude can actually increase your heart rate variability. But it also took for me just one day responding to a call that was particularly shitty with zero opportunity to make a positive difference. And just stepping back, and as a battalion chief, oftentimes we step back and we just watch the scene unfold. We watch the people. And on this particular scene where they were, all they were doing is extricating five dead teenagers from a car. The accident happened the night before. After law enforcement did the investigation, they called us back. And it was just, it was a horrible scene to be on. But what was worse was looking at everybody on that scene. And I remember thinking, like, he's not going to want to stay in this profession. Like, this right here is going to negatively impact him for a long time. And I realized then why gratitude is so important, that if you could just start your day with a little bit of gratitude in those really difficult times, there's something that's happened to remind you that it's not all negative. Because we all know, like, when you're on that really bad call, sometimes it is hard to remember the good or to remember that there is good. So that little piece reminded me just the value of a daily practice of gratitude. But then in just studying more about psychological safety, polyvagal theory, increasing heart rate variability, it was really cool to learn that a couple things, laughter and gratitude, when you're doing those things, your body completely shifts out of fight or flight. Your body shifts back into that rest and digest, homeostasis, growth. So it is a little trick to help your body respond more positively. And then I think a lot of us find ourselves addicted to our phones. You know, you wake up in the morning and the first thing you do is, you know, did I miss anything? And then that leads to, let me go look at Facebook. Let me check email. And before you know it, you've started your day sucked into your phone.
Yep.
Something I've started doing is I'll pick up my phone and I'll put it right in my pocket. I won't even look at it. I make a pot of coffee. And the first thing I'll do, and especially now, I'm glad the weather is getting better, because I like to go sit outside on the porch, drink coffee, enjoy it, and think of things to be gracious for. Yeah. That's just a way to start the day. But also I know in doing so, I'm just preloading my day with something that's going to make me better. But, you know, humor and gratitude are two things that are so incredibly important. And I know specifically humor is something in today's fire service is starting to be more and more eliminated because we're so afraid of offending people and ending up in HR. But we don't realize, and you know, the research on humor is so fascinating. I mean, I've read research about the Holocaust and how even during the death march, how they had to use humor to survive. Yeah. And how just laughter and humor really signals to your amygdala that it's okay. And so just understanding, like, humor is so important. Like, you have to keep humor in the fire service. And I know from, you know, the companies I worked with, I liked it when they made fun of me because that let me know I was a part of the team. Family. Like, there's a video I show in my classes where I just started riding the battalion car and I stopped by my firehouse to eat lunch. And at some point while I was eating lunch, they went to the car and they pushed the seat all the way forward, dropped the steering wheel, raised the seat up. So when I went to get in the car, I could not fit. But of course, as stubborn as I am, I was like, I'm going to get my fat ass in this car and then I will adjust it. But they're recording it the whole time. But what was beautiful about it was the laughter. And like, it was not like a, you assholes. It was like pure joy and laughter and like community. So with that, like, and with what I know from the research, man, I make a point, first of all, to try. I mean, because gratitude is, again, something that I can control. Like, even if it means setting my alarm clock to wake up 3 minutes earlier so I can have that cup of coffee, I'm going to do that because I can control gratitude. Laughter, of course, isn't something we can always control because it requires others most often than not. I mean, I've never tried to laugh by myself. Maybe I should, but, you know, just trying to make sure in the firehouse we are laughing. And have you noticed this thing where the new firefighters have this smile? And then about 2 or 3 years into the job, it goes away. I've noticed that. Like, there's this smile, there's this like energy that newer firefighters bring. And about 3 years into the job, it goes away. And so I'm on this mission to like keep that. Even like, and I know for me it went away, but you know, I try at work to smile. And it's funny, it took that firefighter that I worked with. He actually one day he explained to me that I had RBF and that and he basically was like, you need to smile more. Like, you're so serious all the time. It makes you really hard to read. And I had no idea that I was doing that, but I was trying to portray like that leader. So from that point forward, I just worked on trying to smile more. And then I just realized how contagious that is, but how important that is. So
That's awesome. There's two things. One, the smiling bit. There's really, really cool research about how when you smile, when things are difficult, it will actually change your physiological makeup to where you can embrace more hardship. So your work capacity goes up, your work efficiency goes up. I just read recently, there was, I think it was at a marathon. There's this one section of the marathon, I think at mile 15, somewhere on the back end, where you could be put on this camera and it like changed your like features or something, like a filter or something. And it made you really goofy. And the goal was to make you laugh. And it was almost every single participant in the marathon ran their best mile time right after that happened. So they're pacing over the course of the entire, when you should be like in running purgatory, when sometimes your splits are the worst, they actually improved. So how cool is that? Like, just smiling during hardship literally changes your physical makeup on like a cellular level. Like, how cool is that? And you also mentioned HRV. That's something that I've learned about a lot over the last year. Excuse me. And Whoop is a fantastic metabolic tracker for that. A lot of people don't know what it is. And it's just your adaptability, your heart health and the adaptability to just everyday stressors, and things like alcohol use can affect it. Poor sleep can affect it. The physical, but also emotional stress can affect it. Energy drinks and supplements, like there's so many ways to affect it, but there is also a ton of ways to prop that up. And so the higher numbers show better recovery, more resilience throughout the day. So the more I talk about it, the more I realize that there's a lot of people out there that just don't know what HRV is. So it's just a really cool metric for heart health and just overall resiliency.
Yeah. And it's what I like about HRV. You understand that when you increase your heart rate variability, you increase your capacity to work, to perform, to do so much.
Yeah.
The cool thing about it is you only increase it through relaxing.
Yeah.
Parasympathetic activities, which I believe that a lot of us have to hear, because the fire service is comprised of a lot of workaholics, and we've completely eliminated joy from our lives from this sense in need of performance and showing up. And so, I think just learning more about heart rate variability has significantly positively influenced my life, and just realizing all the different activities that can increase it, and knowing that I don't have to do everything. Like, there's no way I'm going to do every single one of these activities. Like, cold showers, I've tried. Cold plunge, I bought. I hate, I'm not doing. But there are things that I can do. Sleeping more, breathing exercises, just a couple of minutes a day, gratitude, trying to laugh more. And then this big overriding umbrella of psychological safety and creating work environments. And you said it at training days, and it was the simplest definition. You said, if you show up at work and you have to modulate yourself, you're not in a psychologically safe environment. If you show up at work and you can be yourself, that's psychological safety. And I'll just never forget that, because it was so simple. But that's the idea, is let's create work environments where people don't have to modulate themselves. And then we've created work environments where people can perform and people can be emotionally resilient. We spend all this effort And we're doing all this work because we're saying, you know, suicides are, you know, killing firefighters. Firefighters have PTSD, and let's come up with all these treatments and let's have bills passed to where people get benefits. I don't care, and this may be wrong and I'm sorry, but I don't want to fight for benefits for presumptive PTSD. I want to create environments where we don't have it, because the truth of the matter is it's not normal to have long-term PTSD.
Yes. That's
not a normal response to our jobs. And we have normalized it to the point where we're saying that we should expect to disable our first responders and our option is to give them presumptive benefits, which is ridiculous. We know now that we can create environments that can prevent that from happening. It goes back to what you mentioned earlier. Just like the original Air Force manual had so many expressions of love. And the only time I'll ever reference this is like, let's make leadership great again. You'll never hear me ever say anything like that.
Yeah, in any other context, right?
Yeah, I mean it, like leaders have to care about their people. I did research for my EFO and it was all about talking to leaders who created positive cultures. And every single one of those leaders mentioned either caring or loving their members. And yeah. I think that's so beautiful. And we just have to remember, if you care about the people you work with, if you love them and you support them, they're going to do really well. And they're not going to end up disabled and retired always.
That's amazing. That what you just said is so powerful. The fact that we would rather policize and legislate a disease rather than doing the upfront investment work of actually taking care of the human beings that are supporting our organizations and supporting our communities. That's easier and that's more in line with the work they want to do than actually doing the, you know, quote unquote dirty work of taking care of our people. You know, the essence of being a human being and having a community so that we can also go out and serve the community that we're supposed to serve. And that's something that we haven't really talked on, but this I think is the whole underlying theme of, we are generally benevolent organizations. The entire goal is for us to show up on people's worst day. And when we are not hijacked and we can operate efficiently, and when there is team trust from the leader down to the recruit, and we can be a high performing team in these high risk environments, then the community benefits. It's not just us at home. Like, that's such an important piece of it, in the firehouse and at home and behind closed doors, but then also to who we're actually going to serve out in the public, because that's where the rubber meets the road, right? And I think that's not maybe something that's talked about. I think it's kind of assumed, right? But that's why we're here at the end of the day. We're showing up for them. And if we can't show up for ourselves and our teammates, you know, how else are we going to be able to do that?
Yeah, no, I'm blown away by the idea of like presumptive legislation and just expecting people to be disabled and being willing to pay benefits for people to no longer serve, as opposed to paying to ensure that our people can continue to serve.
Yeah, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Like, it's kind of another the aspect of like, well, here's the pill. Here's the easy fix, right? And I think that's what it is. Here's the easy fix. You know, the politicians can get their picture and say, look what we did. But, you know,
we care about our first responders. We are going to assume that this job is going to disable them, and we're going to make sure that they can be disabled and live happy lives. But I don't know any first responder who is truly disabled and is happy that they can no longer serve.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Yeah. And you kind of making this full circle, you mentioned it earlier, and I think it's in Sebastian Younger's book. And I think even Grossman mentioned it in his, like, the combat veterans are rarely the ones that are experiencing PTSD. And if they are, it's like you said, it's the back end result of which a lot of the people experiencing PTSD haven't necessarily been in combat. And I think there's a couple reasons for that. Like, not being, having been able to lean into the mission, that sense of purpose, having the ability to execute on your skills and validate the work that you've done. But bringing it full circle again, the relationships after we get out of it, or maybe it's the change in mission, a change of assignment, or a different call volume, or maybe it's the retirement, you know, that's a common one. You know, the community changes when we don't have it, and we don't have the active listening, and we don't have the empathy, and we don't have the connection. That's when these things start creeping in. So I appreciate what you said about, like, this shouldn't be a long-term thing, right? These are generally more acute things that we can lean in on and dig out and root out through the hard work. It shouldn't be something that sticks with you forever.
No, completely. And yeah, I mean, every bit of research I've done on military and PTSD pointed to the fact that there are greater rates of PTSD and disability among people who were never in combat.
Yeah.
And so then we look at the why, and that's what's so important, is understanding the why behind that. And yeah, they didn't have the close relationships. They didn't have the mission, but also there was unresolved trauma that they brought to the field. Because we know today, as opposed to the draft, more people are entering protective services roles, military, first responders, who are escaping difficult lives. And it's not about saying those people are more susceptible and they shouldn't. It's about saying we have to understand and resolve our trauma in order to continue to serve and be effective. But there, I think there is a lot to be said about the difference between those who were in combat, who developed close relationships, who had mission, versus those who weren't, and why, you know, the rates of PTSD are greater for those who weren't. And one of my favorite books that really did an exceptional job explaining this is The Beauty of a Darker Soul. It was written by an Army West Point grad who was shot in Afghanistan, coded. His highest ranked non-commissioned officer, who, you know, they worked very closely together, died. And he ended up sharing that getting shot never messed him up. He expected that. The only thing that messed him up was being away from his men. But then he went on to explain it was everything in his life that happened prior to being shot that affected his response. It was really fascinating. He said, you know, being shot was just a scapegoat. It was easy for him to blame all his problems on that. And as long as he blamed all his problems on that, instead of truly accepting the truth beyond his struggles, he was never going to heal. And so I loved his story. I love the book because through that, I mean, he empowers us all to, first of all, understand, like, most of us enter this profession or these professions to help people. And we know that there are consequences of that.
Yes.
You know, and I think he gave me the courage to, you know, be able to say, we have to understand like the true sources of our pain, and we have to be willing to address that and move forward.
No, that's beautiful. And there's so many instances of that. And I think that's, you could overlay that story onto so many other people's story. The one you just reminded me of was, Kyle Carpenter got the Medal of Honor from it. He survived ultimately, but with, I mean, had to have dozens and dozens of surgeries, blinded in one eye, time in the hospital. It wasn't the 30 surgeries. It was when he got home from the hospital and was, had to be by himself with his thoughts. You know, his first day out of the hospital, I think his mom was upstairs, and just being alone in a dark kitchen, that's when it all came crashing down on him. And I think you just, you know, your team is gone. The connection is gone. You're no longer a Marine. So now there's a sense of, there's a change in purpose and mission. And obviously he's got an amazing story comes through it, but you could overlay that with military, with the fire service, just that, yeah, the moment that you think all the trouble is going to come crashing down is really the moment you think it is. It's not the incident. Like you said, it's going to be something that happens after that. And that's when the work is really going to start.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah. I know we're banging on almost 90 minutes here. There's one thing I wanted to close with, and this is going to be a total curveball, right? So I know that, I've never actually met your dad, but just looking through your stories, this looks like a guy that I just want to sit and talk to. Like, I want to be a fly on the wall, right? He's out there hunting. He's, you know, taking you around, telling you his daily stories. He's cooking cool food. Like, your dad just looks like a gem. I just want to hang out with that dude for like an hour. Just like, he just seems like an awesome, awesome cat.
Yeah, no, I'm really lucky. Like, my dad is so cool. And I hate that I didn't recognize that earlier in life, because we take for granted the things that we have. Yeah, but 100%. My dad is one of the most exceptional people I've ever met in my life. Like, when I look on his life, I mean, he was born in Palestine. His mom died when he was young. His dad was remarried. When his dad remarried, the new wife didn't want the stepchildren. Yeah. So my dad was left in Palestine with his two siblings alone. And yeah, and so eventually my grandfather's employer brought him to America. So he was 18 years old when he came to America, and he started high school all over again.
Wow.
He was a freshman in high school at 18. He joined the Army as an immigrant in a new country. He joined as a cook because he said he didn't want to go to war, which I think I give him a pass because he left a country that was experiencing war.
For sure.
Yeah, and then he ended up working for the city of Raleigh. But it's these little things about my dad that are exceptional. He built this house in our backyard, like by himself, that has electricity, refrigerator. And it was like his little man cave that he could escape to. He has a garden in the backyard with vegetables and fruits that are all native to Palestine. Like yesterday I was at the house and we were making hummus and we needed some parsley. So we go out there and we look around at everything he has. He has mint leaves, which is traditionally something we put in tea. He has fig trees all over, which was one of his favorite fruits growing up. And he has an olive tree. Like olive trees are very native to Palestine. He has an olive tree. So it was really neat. I got to make hummus with his like vegetables and his olives. But man, my dad is so cool. And I'm definitely like, you see a lot of stories because I'm recognizing like he's 82 years old. I know I have limited time with him. So I want to capture every conversation, every memory, because I'm so lucky. I have such a cool dad.
That's so cool. I love hearing that. I appreciate you just giving us a couple minutes about him. It's just, yeah, just from a distance, I can tell that he's a special guy. So that's cool. I appreciate that.
That really is. He's a really smart guy too. Like,
yeah,
I don't know why I didn't capture any of that, but whatever.
Yeah. That's the innocence in our youth, right? We don't check in on that. So we're all guilty of that.
Yeah.
Like I said, you have your fingerprints in so many areas. You know, you are part of the First Responder Center of Excellence, right?
Yeah, Center for Excellence. It was kind of weird.
Excuse me.
The two organizations were developed the same year. One was the Center of Excellence, which is a treatment center.
Yeah, right.
Center for Excellence, which is an affiliate of the NFFF with the goal to prevent line of duty deaths.
Awesome. Yeah, and that's right here in my backyard in Maryland. Right.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's super cool. And obviously your book, Hope Out of Darkness. Check it out. You're doing amazing work. I'm so honored that you have taken 90 minutes out of your day for me and putting out the good word. So you're doing great things. You're doing special things. I appreciate it. And thank you so much for taking your time out. This is awesome.
No, I think the same of you. I'm honored that you asked me. So I really appreciate it. You're doing amazing stuff. And it means a lot that you not only got my book, but you read it. So thank you.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.